Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my dear friend Bob Bupka. Bob, we are in the final weeks of the Major League Baseball season. A lot of drama unfolding throughout the ballparks of our great country. Some terrific home run chases going on. Aaron Judge and Albert Pujols trying to make history. They've got the President's Cup this week at Quail Hollow. If you watched a little bit of some football last night, the Eagles and the Bills, certainly impressed. And we have a terrific guest today in the legendary sports agent, Donald Dell. Got a lot going on, Bob.
We really do, Kel. And I know our listeners certainly going to enjoy hearing what Donald Dell has to say. Don't forget, manager of Michael Jordan at one time. I mean, he's got some great stories. I know our listeners are going to have a lot of fun learning a little bit on the inside of Donald Dell.
Yeah, Mark McCormick was the very first super sports agent, if you will, who came along as with International Management Group, and he had Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, the big three, as they were referred to, under his fold for quite a number of years. And then when Donald Dell started ProServe, and he brought along tennis greats, Arthur Ashe, Stan Smith, Jimmy Connors, and then when he brokered the deal, Michael Jordan's first deal with Nike, that was quite the game changer. Speaking of Michael Jordan, big golf fan, speaking of Michael Jordan, a North Carolina native, and that is where the President's Cup is being played this week at Quail Hollow in Charlotte. And, you know, Bob, they've played the President's Cup 13 times, and the United States has won 11 times. Only once has the international team won. There's been one tie. It reminds me very much. I think it's very similar to the Ryder Cup, which for years and years and years, the United States just kicked the you-know-what out of the Great Britain and Ireland team until all of Europe came in. And I think you'd kind of be hard-pressed to think that the international team can pull off an upset this week. I mean, the U.S. team is strong, even without having Dustin Johnson and Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka, guys who have been, you know, strong Ryder Cup players in recent years and who have gone on to the LIV golf circuit. The international team just been devastated. I mean, Bob, you can't lose Cam Smith and Joaquin Niemann and Mark Leishman and Abe Anser and Brandon Grace and guys like that and really expect to be competitive. I think they'll make a decent showing, but boy, the U.S. is just seems stacked going into this event.
Yeah, and it actually puts the U.S. in it puts them in a position that you never want to be in. You know, if they win, they're expected to win. If they lose, how the heck could you lose? So I don't know. You know, President's Cup came along to try and capture some of the magic of the Ryder Cup. I think the basic principle has failed, you know, to a huge degree. You know, the United States, you know, there's too many great golfers that are born and raised here and play on the PGA Tour. And when you take the best of the best and put them up against anybody, not going to be good.
I think also, you and I know this well, I think it's hard for the international team. Obviously, this is everything outside of Europe. I just think it's hard for Japanese guys to mesh with Canadian guys, to mesh with Australian guys, and feel like they're one strong unit as opposed to being the European team. And I don't know. It is. To me, it's a junior Ryder Cup in many ways. It's a nice event. The golf course is fantastic. It's hosted a PGA Championship, hosts the Wells Fargo event year to year on the PGA Tour. So the golf course is going to look great. I think you're right. I think, you know, the internationals, they don't have anything really to lose. You know, they're not expected to win. It's just a different level of event compared to the Ryder Cup. I'm not even sure you can compare them, Bob.
No, I don't think there's any comparison whatsoever. I was fantasizing over the last couple of days, and I said maybe the best head-on competition right now would be LIV playing, you know, the United States team. And now that certainly would be filled with a lot of animosity. We might equip the players with not only 14 clubs. We give them a pair of boxing gloves so that they may be ready for some fisticuffs.
Talk about animosity, and no question about it. Hey, a lot of history is being chased right now. Aaron Judge having an unbelievable season for the New York Yankees, and as we talk, he's just too shy of tying Roger Maris for the all-time single-season American League home run record. He's at 59. Maris hit 61 in 61. And then you've got this extraordinary year by Albert Pujols. It kind of came out of nowhere. Red hot in the second half of the season. He's at 698 home runs, needs two to reach that magical 700 number. And there's only three others who've gotten there, Bob. And you talk about legendary figures, Barry Bonds, Hank Aaron, and Babe Ruth. I guess, you know, Bonds, maybe with everything that he put himself through, you can question a little bit of that in terms of how legit those leading numbers are. But Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth, pretty legit guys.
Oh, really? And I think Pujols is an extraordinary player. And the thing that's going to be fascinating to me, if he doesn't get to 700, let's say he finishes at 699, will he agree to come back and start next year and stay until he hits, one or two home runs and then retire? He says no. He says, this is it. Maybe he knows he's going to hit those necessary home runs. We'll have to wait and see. But it's going to be a fun watch, no doubt about that.
Well, it's a fun watch also because he's doing it in the Cardinals uniform that he grew up in and played all those years. Then he went out to the West Coast, and now to come back full circle is meaningful to him, obviously, historically. And the Cardinal organization has been such a big part of baseball for so long. Baseball races coming down the stretch. Three teams have clinched a berth. The Mets did so last night. Max Scherzer picked up his 200th win, six perfect innings. And the Mets, a team that spent a lot of money, really have showed it this year. They're likely going to win the National League East. It hasn't been decided yet, but the LA Dodgers have definitely wrapped up the National League West. The Houston Astros have definitely wrapped up the American League West. Teams that spend a lot of money, Bob, if they do it right, and these organizations are doing it, they win a lot of games, and then it's going to come down to, you know, who's going to have the best possible pitching in what should be a really exciting playoffs for Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot of pieces are falling into place. Great teams, the Dodgers, the Astros, the Yankees. Pretty tough to predict who's going to be the World Series champion this year, and that's a good thing for baseball.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's absolutely the case. We mentioned about Donald Dell, and we're going to hear from him in a minute. I was struck as people are going to hear in this interview that he was a really good player. He was a really good tennis player. He was a Davis Cup captain. He became a lawyer. He didn't really necessarily want to become a sports agent, but as you'll hear in this story, Arthur Ashe was the one who really prompted him to go down that road, and it changed his life, and it really changed professional sports. It certainly changed professional tennis, Bob, which, you know, for a long, long time, tennis was a very much of a gentleman's game, and I don't necessarily say that in a good way. I didn't think it wasn't growing that much. Then when you brought along a guy like Donald Dell, who understood the opportunities on the business side and being able to market the likes of Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith, and then you had Connors and those McEnroe came along, really changed tennis and grew it into the multi-billion-dollar sport it became.
No doubt about it, and I was fascinated listening to Donald Dell, and I guarantee you our listeners of Musings on Sports are really going to enjoy finding out the backstory.
Yeah, a lot of great backstories that you'll hear from Donald Dell in regards to Mr. Ashe and Mr. Smith and Mr. Connors and a guy named Michael Jordan, and you'll hear all that beginning in about 30 seconds after this spot from our good friends at Titleist.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. You know, Bob, from the world of golf, which you and I know very well, no one had more of an impact on the business of the sport than the late Mark McCormick, who started International Management Group, IMG, and who was the agent for the big three of Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and Gary Player. In the same way, our guest today was the giant and the pioneer in the marketing of tennis legends, from Stan Smith to Arthur Ashe to Jimmy Connors. He was enshrined in 2009 as a member of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and it's with great pleasure that we welcome Donald Dell to Musings on Sports. How are you, Mr. Dell?
Fine, thanks. Please call me Donald.
Great to have you, Donald.
It's a pleasure to be here. This will be fun.
Hey, Donald. Bob Bupke here, and I echo the sentiments of Kelly. Thanks for joining us. This is a real pleasure and an honor. I know you were a three-time All-American tennis player at Yale, and you played for the U.S. Davis Cup team back in 61 and 63. Could you shed a little light on what the world of competitive tennis was like in those days?
Well, Bob, it was totally different than it is today. First of all, most of the American summer tennis was all on grass courts. It was a grass court season that started with Marion Cricket Club in Philadelphia, and it went to Southampton, New Jersey, and it went to the Meadow Club in Southampton, and it went to Boston Longwood. It had 5 or 6 weeks in a row of grass court tennis, with the U.S. Open, the finale at Westside Tennis Club in New York. And so in those days, first of all, we used wood rackets. Secondly, everybody was a serve and volleyer on grass. Wimbledon was on grass, and so was Australian Open was on grass. So three of the four championships in the 60s, when I was playing, were on grass. Today, all that's changed completely. And the only grass court major today is really a Wimbledon. And they have a three-week season after the French Open leading into Wimbledon. And then, of course, there's the Hall of Fame tournament in Newport, which is on grass right after Wimbledon. And that's really it for the grass. So when people ask me from time to time, you know, what's different between now and when we played, the game's changed completely, totally different. The rackets are different. They're all graphite. There's no wood. The balls are different. They're slower and fluffier. Scoring is totally different. There was no tiebreaker when we played, and on and on. I mean, you really can't compare the two eras because they're so different today. And the physicality of the players is a tremendous difference. These guys are all playing 4 and 4.5 hour, 5 hour matches in the best of three set finals, and they got to really be in shape. And you know, when you see a guy like Nadal at 35 playing a 5-set, 4.5 hour final in the Australian Open this year, you understand how much more physical the game is being required of the players.
Yeah, it really has evolved in that direction. Let me ask you this, Donald, if you don't mind me referring to you as Donald.
No, please do.
You did play tennis in the Soviet Union, I understand, back in 61. How'd that happen?
Well, it was an interesting thing. Mike Franks and I were playing a tour in South Africa, and the government called us and said they wanted to send two Americans to Russia, be the first to ever compete with Soviet Russia in a competition. We were about 8 or 10 years before the track and field guys went over. So they went over, I think, around 69 or 70, and we were there in 61. And it was really for the State Department that we went. They wanted us to play and show the Russians that we could – Americans could play tennis and learn a little bit about it. And we really enjoyed it. It was an indoor tournament. It was freezing cold at the time, in February. And Mike Franks and I won the doubles. And I think I'm trying to remember who won the singles. I think Mike won the singles. I did not. But what was interesting about it was the people were so poor that were watching. They said they would rush into the locker rooms whenever they could. There's no security or anything. And they would beg you to sell them a wet Lacoste shirt or a pair of shoes. Or, I mean, they just didn't have any tennis equipment in that day. So it was really a PR trip for the government, for the United States government. And we enjoyed it. The competition was good. And I remember getting into an argument with the president of the Tennis Federation of Russia. And he said, you know, we're going to go out and send our players out and try to win the Davis Cup in 5 years. But every time a player went out in the 60s to play for Russia, he always had a bodyguard. They called a trainer who was with him to make sure he didn't defect. And I said to the guy, you're never going to get to be the best team and best Russian players unless you let them go play in America or play them anywhere in the world. And they were very restrictive of their travel when they began. And, of course, all of that's changed today. Now, for example, on the women's side, I would say the Russians really dominate women's tennis. And the problem is there's 6 or 8 very, very good Russian women players, but you can't pronounce their last name. So they don't get much publicity in that regard. It's just hard to do that in an effective way. But the tennis has really improved tremendously in Russia in the days when I played there.
Yeah, to say it has come a long way is an understatement. The legendary tennis agent and 2-time undefeated Davis Cup captain, Donald Dell, joining us on Musings on Sports. Donald, you were enshrined in the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 2009. And on their website, you are appropriately described as, quote, one of the most versatile tennis contributors in history. As you began to segue from being a competitive player to then in 1970, starting ProServe, one of the nation's first sports marketing firms, you had to have seen that there were opportunities there in on the business side. What guided you, what led you to move away from the competitive side of the game to pursue the growing opportunities on the business side of tennis?
Well, it was kind of a fluke of good luck and timing. In 68, when I was the Davis Cup captain in 68-9, the game of tennis went open. By that, for the first time, they acknowledged pros and amateurs could compete against each other in all the major tournaments, like Wimbledon or the U.S. Open. And shortly following that, the Davis Cup became so much more important in those days than it is today. And also, open tennis, you know, was everywhere, just like it is in the Olympics today. Tennis is in the Olympics, and it's open. And so very quickly, in 68, when the game went open, they allowed for prize money and sponsorship to come into tennis. And that's really what's changed the face. I mean, today, there are very, very few pure amateurs. I mean, they don't exist because you have to play so many tournaments, have a points ranking to get into the qualifying or into the main field. For example, a tournament, let's take Washington, which we had 2 weeks ago, the City Open, which I ran for a number of years. To try to get in there, you know, you had a 58 draw with 8 buys, so you had 64 spots to play in. But if you weren't ranked, you know, in about the top 75, you had no chance to get into that tournament. So a pure amateur was not getting any prize money playing for expenses only. He could never get into these individual tournaments on ranking basis. So today, it is very true that with very few exceptions of some super college players, the game of tennis is professional. I'd say 99.44%. It's not even close. And so that is another great change in the game. It's just gone, you know, public. And the way I got involved with ProServe was, it's a funny story, but a true one. I took Arthur Ashe, who was the number one player on my Davis Cup team. I took him to meet Mark McCormick, who you mentioned earlier in the show, 4 times. And after the 4th time, we were driving down the West Side Drive in New York and in a cab. And he said to me, how many more times are you going to do that? And I said, do what? He said, you keep taking me to Mark McCormick, and I'm not very comfortable with him. I don't feel close. I don't have a good feeling about it. You keep taking me back. I said, well, Arthur, I think he would be the best for you. He's got Palmer player Nicklaus in golf. He's got Jean-Claude Killy in the Olympics in 68. He does the Olympic television rights worldwide in 68. And he's a power broker in the sport, and financially, he's really making, he's the pioneer in that side of it. And then Arthur turned to me and said, you know, well, why don't you do it? And I said, why don't I do what? And he said, why don't you represent me? And I said, no, no, I'm going back to Washington where I was working at a law firm, Hogan and Hartson. I said, no, no, I want to go back and be the next Clarence Darrow. I'm not interested in doing that. And then he talked to me some more and said, well, if you did it, you know, Stan would join us. Stan Smith was Arthur's close friend on the Davis Cup. And so when I went back and decided not to join Hogan and Hartson, but to start my own business called the Law Offices of Donald Dell, and there was one person in it, me and a secretary, and that's really how it got started, by his insistence. And of course, Arthur and Stan both turned out to be, you know, fabulous clients. They were both ranked, Stan in number one in the world in 72, and Arthur number one in the world in 75. So they really dominated the early times of tennis in the early 70s.
What a fascinating story. So Donald Dell, it really was at the insistence of Arthur Ashe that the company ProServe that you started ultimately came to be, huh?
There's no question about that. I mean, I would have gone back and really just started practicing again at this trial law firm, except for the fact that the game was going open and money was coming in. Now, by 1970, I started my law office January 1. I retired and resigned from the Davis Cup team. I was lucky because I got in early. I was 29 years old. I ran it 2 years, and I retired undefeated, whereas most players and captains stay too long. They all stay 5 or 6 years because they love the job. And it's fun, a lot of power in tennis, but you can't win 5 or 6 years in a row. So I'm really the only undefeated captain that was in the Davis Cup team forever. And so it shows you can stay too long at something. And that was one.
You know, Donald, in your induction speech for the International Tennis Hall of Fame, you said of both Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith that they're, quote, wonderful people who happen to be great players. Can you give an example or two that illustrate what made the late Arthur Ashe and what makes Stan Smith such great people?
Well, first of all, with both of them, Arthur for 27 years as a client before he died, and Stan today, 52 years out, we're still managing some of his affairs. Both were on a handshake. We didn't have a contract. We just had a handshake. And the best deals are often the simplest deals. But in any effect, I always felt that I wanted to say to people, these were really good. I used to say they were good players, very good players, but they're great people. And that was what the quote was about. And the reason for that is, for example, I'll tell you one quick story. When Arthur won Wimbledon in 1975, Stan and Arthur are the godparents of my twins. I have identical twin girls, and they are godparents of Christina and Alexandra. And when Arthur won 75, I used to chide them, you know, during the season. I'd plan their schedule and go to a lot of the tournaments with them. And I used to tease them. I'd say, you guys have to serve better. You got to play better. My kids have to go to college. Now I want you to play better.
Right.
I used to say that all the time. And when Arthur won Wimbledon in July of 75, after the press conference in the locker room, I don't know, he somehow slipped away, disappeared from me. I wasn't with him for about 15 minutes. And a week or so later, a photograph, a postcard with Arthur on the back, came in to my home unannounced. I never knew about it. And I looked at it and it said, "Dear Alexandra, don't worry, kid. You'll get to college now. Love, Arthur." we kept that postcard, needless to say.
Yeah, that is just great. Wow.
They were spectacular. Stan today, you know, his life story is coming out shortly. We've been working with Stan on a film, and I think he's been a client for 52 years. We've had 8 contracts with Adidas in that time. The last one was a giant one and a very successful one in 2019. So Stan is, you know, as I say, we're still working on a handshake after 52 years, and a lot of things have a lot of water over that dam on those days, but it's been a lot of fun.
You know, we're so pleased to be joined by legendary tennis agent Donald Dell right here on Musings on Sports. Donald, 50 years ago, You were one of the founders of the ATP, the Association of Tennis Professionals. How did that tour come to be?
Well, it was funny. As I say, I retired and started my own business in 1970, which was a law office. And it grew for a while, called Dale Craig Yulfenters and Benton. And my great hero in tennis was a fellow named Jack Kramer, who I believe was the smartest guy in the game. And Jack, I was like Jack's younger brother, and he took me everywhere. And in 72, we were talking, we decided, let's try to form a players association, because the old federations who had run the sport for many, many hundreds of years, there were no pros in those days. And the amateur federations, like the French Federation, the USTA, the Wimbledon, they all were controlling the sport before it was open. And when it went open, they still wanted to try, and Australia, for example, wanted the players to register with the Australian Tennis Federation. They wanted to play Davis Cup. They had to be registered players. And they were putting a lot of restrictions quickly on the players to try to control the sport. And Jack and I felt that the players should have a say in what they do. And so in 1972, we founded a thing called the Association of Tennis Professionals, the ATP. And that was a labor union for the players. You had to pay dues of, you know, probably in those days around $25, $30 each. And you had a real union, and Jack was the first executive director. He worked for a dollar a year. I was his general counsel for 7 years. And that's how we built up the Players Association. We had the Wimbledon boycott in 73, where 73 players didn't play because Wimbledon wouldn't allow Nicky Pilic's entry, a Yugoslav player, hadn't played Davis Cup that year. And so the federations wanted to ban him from playing Wimbledon. Wimbledon accepted the ban, and we said, you can't do that. He's a professional player now. He's not an amateur. He should play Davis Cup for his country, but he didn't have to. He didn't like the captain of the Yugoslav team, and they didn't get along, so he didn't play. And when we said to Wimbledon, please accept his entry, or the following, you know, it actually was 81 players on a piece of paper withdrew their names from the draw, and they didn't believe us. And sure enough, we didn't play all 81. Stan Smith is the only person who never was able to defend. He won in 72, and in 73 would have been the defending champion at Wimbledon, and he didn't play because of the boycott. So, you know, it's been the game has just changed dramatically, and the ATP, of course, today, I think, really runs the sport more and more. They run the world tour. Everything, all the major players and all the important tournaments are held with the ATP, with the exception of the four Grand Slams, Australia, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open. They're run separately and independently, but the tour is run by the ATP, much the way the PGA Tour is run, with the four majors separate. The same idea.
Well, I have to ask you this, Donald. I know you are a commentator for NBC's coverage of major tennis events. What was it like to work with the late, great Bud Collins?
It was a real trip, and every good sense of the word. Bud was really a character. You know, he did the play-by-play. I did the color. He talked about three times more than I did. And I said to him, you always make me look good because you talk so much and I pop in every now and then. And, you know, you're putting them to sleep and I'm trying to wake them up. But he was fabulous. He was really fabulous as a commentator. I mean, he would make things up. Like, for example, he had a thing called Fingers Fortescue. Fortescue, he said, is a real guy living in California. He's the one who puts his finger on the net cord for let cords. And he kept talking about Fingers Fortescue everywhere we went. We started getting letters and calls about this guy, Fingers Fortescue, which he made him up. He's made the guy's name up. There's no such being. But that's an example of the colorfulness and the creativity of Bud Collins. It was a joy to work with him. We had some great times together. Wonderful.
Well, and the color and the creativity, as far as Bud's apparel, Donald, come on.
Oh, yeah. No, he was. Well, I'll tell you one quick story about Bud that was the other side. When we won the Davis Cup in 68, the government asked us to fly and stop over in Vietnam on the way home and go to hospitals and air bases to give a lift to the soldiers over there. So we were there for about 6 days with the team, and Bud was traveling with us as the press guy. And we went into Saigon one time, and we were in a 5-hour meeting with General Westmoreland, where he was explaining everything about Vietnam and the war. And it literally was questions and answers from about 10 people, our whole team, and a couple of other soldiers. It went on for over 4 hours, this meeting, and Bud was in the meeting. And the next morning, I get a call out of the blue from the Defense Department, and they said, you have someone on your team traveling by the name of Bud Collins. And I said, yeah, sure I do, but he's not a player. He's with the press. And the guy on the end of the phone said, well, I got news for you, Donald. You're the captain of the team. You represent America. We want Bud Collins out of the country at 5 o'clock today. And I said, why is that? They said, because he just wrote a blistering front page on Vietnam and General Westmoreland for the Boston Globe. So I went to Bud and said, Bud, you know, you got to get out of here shortly by 5 p.m. today.
Yeah.
You're on the plane out of here. But I said, why in the hell wouldn't you tell me you're doing something like that? Because it just caught me off guard. And I mean, he was very controversial and very lovable. He was what I call a lovable rascal with Bud Collins. You really enjoyed being around him.
Well, a great way to sum up a remarkable man. We are indeed in the final set with the International Tennis Hall of Famer, Donald Dell. Donald, you also represented Jimmy Connors during his heyday as a tennis star. What a star he was in so many ways. Donald, what was he like? Certainly, what was he like at that time? And how did you go about growing Jimmy Connors' brand beyond the court? Because you had a very, very different personality in Jimmy as opposed to Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith.
Totally different. Jimmy Connors, in those days, you know, in the 80s, really sold more tennis tickets than anybody in the game for about 10 years. I mean, he was a real colorful guy. He was a fierce competitor, and he loved it. You know, he talked to the crowd. He was a little bit like Nick Kyrgios is today, but he was a winner. I mean, he was able to get a crowd on his side, and he was a wonderful, tremendous competitor, totally different. He was sort of a loner. He didn't join the ATP. He was very close to his mother, Gloria, who coached him. And now Jimmy, if you really looked at it historically, was a heck of a great player. Probably, you know, he won slams about 7 times. I think he won the U.S. Open 4 times. I know he won Wimbledon 2 or 3 times. Won the Australian Open once. The only tournament he didn't win was the French Open on clay, which was not his best surface. But representing him, I mean, he would do things competitively and determinedly that you have to see to believe. He would have been phenomenal fitting right in with today's game because, believe it or not, when he would play a tournament like in Washington, he asked me, he'd say, I want to play in the middle of the day. I want to play when it's really hot. And I said, gee, why do you want to do that, Jim? He said, because everybody else hates the heat, hates the sun, and they're trying to stay away from it. When I play them, I want to play I'm ready to play in the sun because I like the heat. And so he tactically wanted to be scheduled like at 2 or 3 in the afternoon in Washington in August is not a very cold day. But that was his way of competing. He felt it gave him an edge because he had been practicing in the sun, playing matches in the sun. So he was ready for anybody that mattered in the quarterfinals or semis by playing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Donald, we've talked strictly about tennis to this point, but as you well know, as ProServe expanded, you ultimately took on Michael Jordan as a client. I wonder if you could talk in regards to two legendary shoe deals, two huge changes in the shoe industry that you helped to get done. First, the initial Nike shoe deal for Michael, and then the Stan Smith deal with Adidas, both of which were true game changers in the business of sports footwear.
Well, you know, it's funny. Dean Smith, the coach of North Carolina, called me on a Saturday morning. I had been working to manage a lot of Carolina players over the years, and Dean trusted me. And he said, would you like to manage Michael Jordan? I'm here with his mother and Michael in my office. And I said, sure, I'd love to. Heck yes. I never knew how good he was going to be, but he was certainly one of the top college players that year. They had won the national championship for Carolina. And so Coach Smith said, well, here, let me put Michael on the phone. And I said, Michael, are you anxious to turn pro? He said, no, I'm not. He said, I'm a junior. I'd like to go one more year and graduate. But Coach Smith tells me I should come out now as a junior, that the time is ripe, and I want, you know, I want you to look over the market and find out if that's correct. So Michael Jordan actually left Carolina as a junior, didn't really want to leave, but later on went back and graduated. He got his degree, to his credit. Michael, we managed for 10 years at ProServe, and he wore Converse when he was playing at Carolina, and of course Adidas and Nike were competing strongly to see who would get him when he got out of college. They wanted to put him in their shoes. We went with Nike primarily because of Phil Knight and the way they negotiated. I wanted a name shoe after Jordan, and they wanted a Nike shoe. And I remember it was one morning in our office, there were four of us sitting there, Rob Strasser and Peter Moore from Nike, and myself and my assistant at the time was a guy named David Falk. And we sat on Saturday morning in my office, and suddenly, arguing back and forth, Peter Moore suddenly said, you know, we wanted a name shoe, they wanted a Nike shoe. And suddenly Peter Moore said, what about something like Air Jordan? And everybody just kind of stopped. I mean, we thought, Air Jordan, that's, you know, he's a jumper, he's a leaper. That was his logo, is going to be designed as a leaper. And we said, God, Air Jordan, that would be fantastic. And that's actually how the name Air Jordan originated. I've heard many different variations of many people saying how they got thought of it and did that and the other. I'm not going to name names, but the end result was Peter Moore just kind of threw that out in the middle of a meeting on a Saturday morning about 10:30 in my office in Washington. So that led to us ending up going with Nike in the first year. And 3 years, 4 years out, we negotiated a second deal where the royalty income was just enormous. And following that, Phil Knight came to us and wanted to talk about a long-term company deal. Now, I did not negotiate that, because Michael had left ProServe in 93. But that was the forerunner. The shoe was making so much money. Nike was getting stronger and stronger in basketball shoes. And that's where they came up with the idea of a separate company, a sales company called Jump Inc., which is really a tremendous relationship between Michael Jordan and Nike. As I say, I did not negotiate that, but I know a lot about it. And it's a phenomenal deal for Michael. He's the president of it, and Nike runs it. But I believe that, you know, they're splitting profits of the company. And it's become a $2 billion sales company now at Nike called Jump Inc., which is Michael Jordan's logo. And to his credit, Michael, that I think is what's contributed a lot of his income today, where he can afford to build his own golf course and go into car racing in a lot of different ways, because he's way beyond just a royalty on a shoe. It's way beyond that in owning a piece of a very successful company, which is also owned with him by Nike.
And Donald, the iconic Stan Smith shoe with Adidas, how did that come about?
You know, won Wimbledon in 72, and Horst Dassler, the chairman of Adidas in France and Germany, called me on the phone about 4 or 5 weeks after Wimbledon and said, I really want to talk and meet Stan Smith, because I'm coming to the American market a year from now, and I'd like to have an American endorsing my shoes. And I teased Horst a little bit. Said, well, you can't afford Stan. How about somebody else? And that was just to tweak him a little bit, because he was a tremendous competitor. And he said, I can afford it. Don't you worry about that. So we met, and Stan signed a contract. The original first one was in 73. And there was a French leather shoe endorsed by a Frenchman named Robert Hayer. And so for a year, the shoe was called the Hayer Smith shoe, which when Haye retired and had a new contract with Stan, his name took over the shoe as the first leather shoe. And in the 70s, when he wore it, it was a competitor. It was a performance shoe. I mean, he wore that shoe at Wimbledon, at the U.S. Open on grass. And that was the first leather shoe. So it was kind of a new first and a new kind of different deal. And since 1973, over a period of, you know, nearly 50 years, I've signed 7 different other contracts for Stan with Adidas. And it's been sort of a lifelong journey. I mean, Stan is 75 now, and just signed an enormously long-term contract with Adidas today. In fact, it's what they call in perpetuity. This contract that came and said, we want to continue with him as long as he lives, as long as his heirs, as long as the heirs of his heirs. And so we have a very long-term contract that only ends on certain conditions. If they were to totally stop, you know, making or designing the name Shoe Stan Smith or shoe similar to that in design, that's the only way it would end. So it's a quite an extraordinary shoe deal for Stan. And as he often said, some people still think of him as a shoe rather than a person, because a lot of people don't know that Stan Smith won Wimbledon, won the U.S. Open, and won Wimbledon. And they don't know that because that was in the 70s.
And I'd like to know, in your opinion, your greatest on-court accomplishment and maybe your greatest moment in the business world while you were at ProServe.
Well, it was always a great thrill, obviously, as the captain of the Davis Cup to win it twice, being Harry Hopman in Australia the first year in 68. But as far as my individual play, I was a sophomore at Yale, and I was playing at Newport on grass, and I played Ashley Cooper there in the second round. I was 19 years old. Cooper had just won Wimbledon the week before and flew over to play continue to play on grass on the Hall of Fame tournament there. And I won the first set 10-8 on one of the outside courts, and it was raining. And so I had spikes. The referee said I could wear my spikes. He didn't have spikes. And so he grumbled a lot, but it turned out that the second set, I don't think he worked very hard at it. He had just won Wimbledon, as I say, 2 weeks before, and he came over, took a week off, then came over to play Newport. It was kind of a holiday for him. But anyway, for me at 19, it was the best win I might have ever had, being a Wimbledon champion, 10-8, 6-1, on an outside court at Newport. As far as in business, I would have to say that the business really has been more of the Stan Smith shoe than any other, because you've got to understand the longevity of that. I mean, Stan, you know, is 75 years old today, and yet the shoe we've had 8 contracts over the period of 50 years, and the total number of pairs of Adidas shoe with Stan's name on it is probably a little over 100 million pairs since we started. So the longevity of that is quite remarkable. And so I think that from a business point of view may have been one of my best achievements.
Well, Donald Dell, it's been a pleasure having you on Musings on Sports. That cab ride that you shared with Arthur Ashe Lowe those many years ago certainly changed the course of your professional life and absolutely changed the business of sports, first on the tennis side and then with none other than Michael Jordan. Donald Dell, again, thank you so much for joining us on Musings on Sports.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Bob, just as we had said leading into the interview with Donald Dell, he brought a perspective, a business savvy to tennis that hadn't existed and coincided somewhat with, you know, the rise in golf with Arnold and Jack. And you had great personalities as well with Connors and Ash and Smith. And Donald Dell was certainly a big part of the growth on the business side, certainly, of tennis.
Well, he had the vision. That's all I can say. Yeah. He had the vision.
Yeah, and if you have that vision, you see things that a lot of people don't, and he accomplished a lot. So we want to thank Donald Dell very much for being our guest on Musings on Sports. And Bob, you and I very much look forward to our guest next week, Archie Manning, who is one who achieved so much at Ole Miss as the quarterback there, but as the father of of two guys, Peyton and Eli, who've gone on to win a combined 4 Super Bowls. Archie's pretty special guy in many respects, and a very loving dad to an incredible family of football players.
Absolutely incredible story. I mean, to have a son make it to the NFL is one thing. To have two sons make it to the NFL and both win Super Bowls, you got to be kidding me, Archie. That sounds a little greedy.
It may be greedy, but Archie's a terrific man. It was great spending time with him, and I know that our listeners will enjoy that next week. We encourage everyone to continue to listen to Musings on Sports. I post it on my Facebook page, and you can certainly listen to Musings on Sports wherever you enjoy your podcast. For Bob Bubka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Thanks again for joining us on Musings on Sports.